I was going to ask Dick about the accuracy of your rockets. You know, you said you had seven basically in pods on each wing. You know, how accurate were you? I mean, I was an O2 guy, and I could sit there, and from low altitude, I could stick a rocket about anywhere I wanted to. But from high speed and high altitude, I would imagine that would be a little bit more difficult. Were your rockets very, very easy to aim, or was it just kind of, hey, get it in the ballpark and then talk them onto the target? Oh, he's laughing. Okay, this.
Well, Ed. See, the Misty pilots were about as good as they come.
Got it.
And we put that rocket any place.
I guess that's the answer.
If you're going after a real active, like 57, 37 millimeter, six position gun sight, what you want to do is put it just upwind so as the smoke would blossom, it would hide them, and then that would help protect the first guy down the chute to kill him. We were that good.
You are good. I agree. And did you ever carry anything other than Willie Pete's, other than white phosphorus rockets, or was
no,
that?
Those are the only thing that we carried. And okay. We were Ford air controllers, and that was our armament, and that's where dismarking. And they're not supposed to do anything else.
Yeah.
We'd violated that, and that's why I got shot down.
Yeah, and as long as you brought that up, let's go into that story.
Okay,
His last mission, as I remember.
Let me tell you a couple of stories about rescues and so forth. And first of all, I want to introduce another celebrity that we have in the audience, and it's Rob. Stand up, Rob. Robert, I went around the world horizontal in the Voyager. Here's the guy that decided to go around the world from pole to pole. Thank you, Rob. That's pretty neat.
Ooh.
Got a great story. Okay. Okay, everybody likes war stories, I get. And there was a couple of them. The only general officer to die in the whole Vietnam War, to die in combat, Air Force officer, only one. His name was General Bob Worley.
Yep.
And he burned alive in the front cockpit of an RF-4 Phantom in the summer of 1968. The reason I know that I was sitting on his wing about 4 feet from him and watched him immolated in the cockpit shook me up pretty bad. Let me tell you about a typical Misty mission. The Misties, their day started about 2 or 3 hours before dawn. We go down and get an intelligence thing because we wanted to know where the flow of supplies were, where the interdiction points, how successful we were at different airstrikes to try to, and it was a big intelligence thing we went through. So if you were going up there the first one in the morning, then you had to be aware and get all briefed up on what's going on. So about an hour, 40 minutes before dawn, every morning at Phu Cat, there was a single F-100 that would light that afterburner and roar down that fog-shrouded runways and Phu Cat climb up on top. And everybody knew that was a Misty and where he was going. And he probably would not be back until noon, because those missions were 5 and 6 hours long with multiple aerial refueling. It's really nice to have your own tanker. You don't have to share it. I says, he's mine. Don't mess with my tanker. So a lot of times we would come out sucking on fumes if we were involved in rush caps and stuff. And you sit behind this, off North Vietnam, you roll in behind this tanker and think, boy, if I mess this up, I'm going to get frowned at. Anyway, we have this intelligence briefing. The guy in the back seat, by the way, we swap back seat, front seat, every other mission, back and forth. And the guy in the front, he was the commander, and he was the one that flew the mission and decided what targets we're going to hit and so forth. And if you were in the back that day, you had a bunch of maps and grease pencils, and you're writing grease pencil information on the soft. You would check the fighters in, find out what their ordnance is, determine what the target was and the time over target, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And if you would see something, a transshipment point, a truck park, other things, and you didn't have any fighters to go after them, then you had to record all that and come back. So it's a big intelligence thing. So that little Missy every morning would take off and climb out and head for North Vietnam. Mm-hmm. We go up and refuel off the tanker. And when you're flying an airplane, you know you do what you got. You got checklists, fuel refueling things, all those things that happen that you're doing, you're kind of busy. And then all of a sudden, you back off of the tanker, you descend, and you turn toward North Vietnam. And every morning, we try to penetrate the airspace at different places so they didn't get used to where we were coming in. And that was, and all of a sudden there was really nothing to do. You arm the rockets, you arm the gun sight, arm the 20 millimeter cannons, you tighten the chin strap, put the visor down, make sure the damn seat pins were out of the thing. Everything was all tight. You turned all your emitters off and make darn sure you weren't broadcasting with lights or transponders or something like that. And then there was a handful of minutes as you descended from 24,000 feet and you wanted to hit the coast of North Vietnam at a random place. And you wanted to go really fast. And usually in the morning, the coastal plain, it's all farmland, rice paddies and so forth, and the visibility is kind of low, not really very good. But I tell you what, it's the most peaceful, smooth air you've ever flown in. Beautiful. And you look up there, and what comes into view as North Vietnam comes up, it's the most peaceful, solemn place you'd ever think. Nothing happening. And then when the first gunners shoot you, sight you, what they did it every morning is they'd fill the whole sky full of tracers. And in the low, dim light of the early morning, you could see every one of those things, from 50 cal to the larger 57, 37 millimeter, and a lot of ZPUs that you can't even see. You'd fill the sky. Now, you're a little ominous feeling going in there, but when the first time that thing shoots and they're shooting at you, it all changes. Aha! And I say there's a little combat gland. It's right here, I think. You can feel it there, and you know where it is. And it only gets active when you get shot at. But what the endorphin that that little combat gland pumps into your body is incredible. It's euphoric. But the bad thing is, it is extremely addictive. And if you go up there and nobody's shooting at you, you go and mess with them to get you to shoot at it. And when you get shot at, the gland comes and you get this big hit. And then our mission from then on was just to play a lot of high G, a lot of random. And your jinking was always random because all the roads were crooked. They kind of did it for themselves. And so then was fights on. And our job was to find truck marks, is to try to find the strikes that happened during the night and all the things you do to stop the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And then before you know it, it's noon. And you may have done a rest cap, and you may put on a bunch of fighters. And there must have been intense enemy ground fire. One thing that I like to do was, and they didn't like this of me, but if somebody shoots at you, the ability to go back and kill them is very important. And I couldn't understand a lot of people that have to fly straight and level with people shooting at you, and you can't do a damn thing about it. But if you're a missy fact, you can go back and kill them. Now, our policy up there was that there's some gun sites that were really good, and some of them were really bad. And every morning, we go and meet the kid on the cars, and he was just over the border into Laos, and he set up in the top of this car, and he had a 50-caliber 50 caliber gun, machine gun. And I don't know how he got the gun up there or how he got the ammo up there, but every single morning, he would greet us. Now, he's going around the circle, and without exception, if we were over here, he would always shoot over there. So we'd always take a new guy up there and introduce him to the kid on the cars, and he was so bad. There was never any danger to anybody, but it was a learning, it was a training aid. It was really good. And so all of us missies knew if that guy, nobody would touch him because he was very bad. We delivered his mail for him. We put his lunch in the speed brake well and flew over and dropped him because we wanted to take care of him. So you perpetuate incompetency, but every once in a while, there'll be a gun sight that's really camouflaged. And for some reason, you missed it. And you turn and you have your belly up. If you have your belly up to the gun sight, then they will shoot. But they better kill us, because if they don't, they know what's going to happen. And sometimes you can feel those rounds coming by like a baseball bat pounding on the edge of the bottom of the airplane with the shock waves. And I swear to God, sometimes I was sitting there in the refueling poop, sometimes the tracers would come right between it. Well, maybe not, but it felt good like that. So when they would shoot, I'd roll back and look at them, and then they had a black ring. You guys that flew up there, they have a black ring around the gun sight that would be drifting away. He says, "You were really good. You were really clever. You got to die." And so then we just orbit right over them, the top of them. Sometimes we could have ordnance that was readily available, or we could divert a couple of flights off the Alpha Strike Force going downtown Hanoi. But we'd just be out of their range and orbit them. And I like to mess with them because they knew what the drill was going to be. Pretty soon I'd be joined with a couple of flight of four F-5s, F-105s, or F-4s. It's a lot of gun-killing ordnance. And I often wonder what those little guys were thinking about on the ground as we orbited over them. And they knew one thing, that if the Misty marked them, they were done. You ever the feeling when you're a kid and you go to the swimming pool and you make this big mistake, you climb up on the high dive? Remember that feeling? And you walk out on the edge of the high dive and you think, God, I don't want to be here. This is, it looked like a mile high. And you just, for all the world, you want to turn around and go down the ladder, but then your friends are down there and there's no way, and you're forced to jump. That feeling you have? But it's weight orbit. We'd brief them with the bailout areas, where the winds were, what the altimeter setting was, what the gun sights were. And then, when it's all the briefing was done, then somebody had to mark them. And I take a deep breath and says, wow, because I know what's going to happen in the next handful of minutes. In the orbit, they knew all about us because we were up there all the daylight hours, there was a Misty up there someplace. And so the Misty would roll, wings verted, and you pull your nose down. Now, as soon as you rolled inverted and pulled your nose down, all those gun sights opened up. And you were the only target. Now, normally, if you're flying by real fast, they have to lead you and there's a solution. But there's a time when there's no solution required if you're a gunner. And that means when the airplane is coming directly at you. You don't have to lead anybody or anything. You just shoot at him because he's coming directly at you. So you want to minimize that time. So you roll it over. And all the tracers are coming up all around you, and you pull the nose down, and you roll out. And it took all the willpower you could ever muster to take that second and a half of tracking to make sure the solution was just right, and then pickle off that one Willie Pete. Now, normally you'd pull off straight ahead, but you never pull off straight ahead. When I'd fire, I roll inverted like that and pull down towards the ground and then back around up like that. And then I look at the accuracy of my mark. And if it was good, you could just say, hit my smoke. But almost invariably, if we were going after gun sights, the whole world with a square mile knew where the gun sight was. Because if you've ever seen a six position, 57 millimeter gun sight, and the muzzle flashes were huge, and those tracers, they were big as your fist coming up. You roll out, you mark the target, pull off, and then lead rolled in. He'd rolled in and try to hit him. And the flight of three, he was down the chute first. I'd come out the other side, and I'd come back around and head on to number two coming in to try to draw some fire from number two, and we'd cross. And then number four would come in, and hopefully in that iteration, we turn that gun sight into a sand hill. Mess with a miss of you, guy. We'll come back and fix you.